This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and today on the show, we're going to the edge. Do you introduce yourself as the craziest in the world?
I'm never quite sure what my job title should be.
That could be your job. That could be your business card.
I would happily have that on a business card, yeah.
That's Ben Saunders.
Yeah.
Polar explorer. What does it feel like to be the only human being standing in an area bigger than the United States?
It's hard to say. I mean, it was really difficult. The North Pole, the geographic North Pole, is in the middle of the sea. I often would imagine myself as, I'd imagine one of those sort of infrared thermal images of this giant ice cap. In the sort of some kind of blue, dark blue, you know, way below freezing. And then this tiny little pinprick of heat. I was very aware of my little speck of heat and how precious that was. It's the kind of place where you could, I guess you could lose it pretty easily up there. I try not to go too far down that path of thinking, you know. So, yeah, when it's close to minus 50 centigrade, you can't really have any skin exposed. And yeah, I'd often feel, you know, lying there in my tent at night, that there must be this sort of few inches of ice and then this, you know, deep black ocean beneath me. And there were many days out there when the weather was bad and it was very cold and very windy and often poor visibility, that it felt like that place didn't want me there. You know, when it was tough, it was generally very, very scary, yeah.
How many people have done this, what you've done?
There are three of us that have skied solo to the North Pole.
Three, that's a small club.
It's a small club, and no one's done it since. So my trip in 2004 could have been a world last. There have been a few attempts since then, but the conditions are getting worse every year, so no one's done it since.
Like Ben Saunders, all our TED speakers today have gone to the edge, across oceans or in the skies above us and the caves deep below. And the question is why?
I'd always admired and respected people that were, you know, at the very outer edges of what's possible. But I'd always, I still struggle with the why question. I've had, years now to think of a pithy one-liner to sort of deflect that question. And if I'm honest with myself, it's a really, really hard one to answer.
And that why question? Well, as the story goes, the most famous answer given was by the explorer George Mallory, who, when asked why he wanted to climb Mount Everest, said, because it's there. And in his TED Talk, Ben Saunders went on to read what Mallory actually said.
And again, I've printed this, I'm going to read it out. The first question which you will ask, and which I must try to answer, is this. What is the use of climbing Mount Everest? And my answer must at once be, it is no use. There is not the slightest prospect of any gain whatsoever. We shall not bring back a single bit of gold or silver, not a gem, nor any coal or iron. We shall not find a single foot of earth that can be planted with crops to raise food. So it is no use. If you cannot understand that there is something in man which responds to the challenge of this mountain, that the struggle is the struggle of life itself, then you won't see why we go. What we get from this adventure is just sheer joy. And joy, after all, is the end of life. We don't live to eat and make money. We eat and make money to be able to enjoy life. That is what life means, and that is what life is for. Mallory's argument that leaving the house, embarking on these grand adventures is joyful and fun. However, it doesn't tally that neatly with my own experience. I was dragging 180 kilos of food and fuel and supplies, 400 pounds. The average temperature for 10 weeks was minus 35, minus 50 was the coldest. So again, there wasn't an awful lot of joy or fun to be had. One of the magical things about this journey, however, is that because I'm walking over the sea, over this floating, drifting, shifting crust of ice that's floating on the surface of the Arctic Ocean, it's an environment that's in a constant state of flux. The ice is always moving, breaking up, drifting around, refreezing. So the scenery that I saw for nearly 3 months was unique to me. No one else will ever, could ever possibly see the views, the vistas that I saw for 10 weeks. And that, I guess, is probably the finest argument for leaving the house. I can try to tell you what it was like, but you'll never know what it was like. And the more I try to explain that I felt lonely, I was the only human being in 5.4 million square miles. It was cold, nearly minus 75 with wind chill on a bad day. The more words fall short, and I'm unable to do it justice. And it seems to me, therefore, that the doing, you know, to try, to experience, to engage, to endeavor, rather than to watch and to wonder, that's where the real meat of life is to be found, the juice that we can suck out of our hours and days.
Well, can you walk us through a day, from when you woke up until when you went to sleep?
Yeah. So I'd wake up. I'd often have this sort of. I'd have extraordinary dreams, and this is something that has continued. I'd have vivid Technicolor dreams. I think it might be to do with a sort of lack of stimulus during the day. You're skiing through a place that's largely white. There's nothing really living up there. There's no real change in the scenery. So my theory was that really my brain's way of compensating for the lack of stuff that was going on.
But of course, eventually, he'd wake up.
Often I'd have this sort of split second of thinking, oh, I'm still here.
And then the routine would kick in.
The first thing I'd do from my sleeping bag is sort of reach out and light the stove. Doing everything that they tell you not to do in the Boy Scouts, I was cooking with a pressurized petrol stove inside a highly flammable tent,
The night before, he'd gather up
blocks of snow that I would store in the porch of the tent. So I'd reach out, grab some snow, chuck it in the pot, start melting snow to get water.
Melt enough snow for the day's water.
And then one of the very last things I'd do would be to make breakfast.
Usually some freeze-dried powder and hot water, and then
take the tent down, pack the sled, and head north. And psychologically, that was always, it was often quite a difficult thing to do because the tent represented, my home and safety in a way, and to dismantle it every day and to head off again into this relatively risky world was always quite a big wrench mentally.
But of course, you had to keep going.
And then, start skiing north. I would just keep it on the watch. I'd stop every hour and a half and sit on the sledge and pull out my bag of food and drink and refuel.
Ski for 9 or 10 hours and then make camp again.
Yeah, put the tent up, dig up some snow, get in the tent, get in the sleeping bag, light the stove, eat, drink, zip it all the way up and go to sleep.
What did it feel like to arrive there, to the top of the world, to 90 degrees?
Well, in some ways, getting to the North Pole was the ultimate anticlimax because there is nothing there. It's sea ice. It's always drifting. Even if someone had stuck a flag there and left it there a few years before, it wouldn't be there. It would drift away. When I sat down on the sledge and took some photographs and looked at the GPS a few minutes later, I was no longer at the North Pole. I was a few feet away. I drifted away. In other ways, it was one of the most satisfying achievements of my life, I guess, just getting to that point. Yeah, my team was advised that I should be picked up very early on that trip because the ice conditions were too bad. So I kind of felt like I'd proved a few people wrong, and I was pretty proud of myself, I guess.
I mean, this was like the thing that you wanted to achieve up to that point your whole life. Like, you got to that place, and then what? Like, did you sort of think, well, okay, I've done it?
Yeah, it's very strange. Actually, I think when I was out there, I always have this kind of goldfish memory because I spend so much of my life, you know, counting down the days until the next expedition, you know, just this sort of excitement, like, oh, yeah. And then when I get out there, one of the very first things I'll do in the back of my diary, almost like a prisoner, is start counting down the days until I get home, you know, until I'm back to safety and warmth and, you know, dry land. And I think for a lot of that trip in 2004, it was, you know, the thing I was looking forward to wasn't really, certainly in a short-term sense, wasn't the North Pole. It was getting home again.
This October, Ben and a partner will attempt the longest unsupported polar expedition ever. They're going to walk from the coast of Antarctica all the way to the South Pole and back. They're calling it the Scott Expedition. They named it for the explorer who first attempted that walk back in 1911.
It'll take us about 4 months, and it'll also be a four-month chance for me to finally come up with a pithy answer to the question, why? And our lives today are safer and more comfortable than they have ever been. There certainly isn't much call for explorers nowadays. You might, my careers advisor at school never mention it as an option. If I wanted to know, for example, how many stars were in the Milky Way, how old those giant heads on Easter Island were, most of you could find that out right now without even standing up. And yet, if I've learned anything in nearly 12 years now of dragging heavy things around cold places, it is that true, real inspiration and growth only comes from adversity and from challenge, from stepping away from what's comfortable and familiar and stepping out into the unknown. In life, we all have tempests to ride and poles to walk to, and I think, metaphorically speaking at least, we could all benefit from getting outside the house a little more often. If only we could summon up the courage. Thank you very much.
Polar explorer Ben Saunders. Check out his talk at ted.npr.org. And you can follow his Scott Expedition at scottexpedition.com. And one last question we asked Ben, one that you may have been wondering about as well.
As quickly as possible is the short answer.
Yeah.
If it's very cold or very windy, then your fingers go numb. So ram your hand in. I hope you've got hold of the right bit because you can't feel anything. 10% of the time, realize actually you're not holding anything at all. You're, you know, peeing down your leg. That's starting to freeze. and then zip everything up before anything gets too cold. So
yeah.
It's not quite as harrowing as it sounds, but you have to be pretty quick about it.
So I guess Patagonia and North Face haven't figured out what to do about that problem yet, huh?
Yeah, not quite, no.
I'm Guy Raz. More TED Radio Hour in a moment from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and today on the show, we're talking to people who've gone all the way to the edge, and we're asking them why. Back when Bill Stone was in high school, he decided he wanted to go to the moon, which, as we'll hear later, he still does. But anyway, one day, as he was walking to class, he saw a flyer was pasted on the wall, and it was for something called the Spelunking Club.
The Spelunking Club. And I said, I don't know what that word means, and I got my mother to take me over to the meeting, and suddenly, here was this thing about exploration. There was an image of a person on rope rappelling into a black abyss. It was such a perfect shot because the pure, utter blackness of what he was rappelling into, the starkness of him against that, the sun shining down on this moss-lit shaft. It was just like Jules Verne right there before my eyes. And that was it. That was the scene that got me hooked right away.
And everything changed at that moment. Cave exploring actually became his profession, a life right at the edge of human possibility. What you do is climb Everest in reverse. I mean, these caves are as deep as Everest is high.
That's true, but with one critical difference. On Everest, they're shedding weight as they're coming down, and they're coming down light. We don't have that option. When we're at the bottom of a cave, you actually have to pull your way back out. So the hard part starts, at the bottom.
Here's Bill's TED Talk.
One of the things that's changed here in the last 150 years since Jules Verne had great science fiction concepts of what the underworld was like is that technology has enabled us to go to these places that were previously completely unknown and speculated about. We can now descend thousands of meters into the earth with relative impunity. Along the way, we've discovered fantastic abysses and chambers so large that you can see for hundreds of meters without a break in the line of sight. When you go on a thing like this, we can usually be in the field for anywhere from 2 to 4 months with a team of as small as 20 or 30 to as big as 150.
What does it feel like to be inside those caves?
Yeah, it's sensory deprivation is what it is. Imagine going into a world that consists nothing of blacks and browns and some occasional tans, and maybe if you're really lucky, you know, a dash of white here and there by, you know, calcite in the vein of a rock or something like that. So it's monotonous color accompanied by the low rumble or hiss of water, ubiquitous. It's just kind of rattling around sonically through all these chambers because the river is always there. You can be a level or two above it, or you can be right into it. If you're into it, it's loud. It's loud enough that it's shaking the walls as if you were standing beside a locomotive. You can physically feel the acoustic, you know, resonance. And so the longer you spend down there, the more you get acclimated to that sensory-deprived environment, such that when you come back to the surface, there's a period of about 15 to 20 minutes where you're in sensor overload. Colors that are hot colors just leap out, almost in 3D. You can hear things like buzzing insects far farther away. And the other thing is, you can usually smell the entrance from within anywhere from 500 meters to 800 meters inside, just because the wind is carrying that subtle scent down into the cave. It's this heightened state of sense until you reach the point of saturation.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. We have already gone far beyond the limits of human endurance from the entrance. This is nothing like a commercial cave. You're looking at Camp 2 in a place called J2, not K2, but J2. We're roughly 2 days from the entrance at that point. And the idea is to try to provide some measure of physical comfort while you're down there, otherwise in damp, moist, cold conditions in utterly dark places. I should mention that everything you're seeing here, by the way, is artificially illuminated at great effort. Otherwise, it is completely dark in these places. The deeper you go, the more you run into a conflict with water. It's basically like a tree collecting water coming down. And eventually, you get to places where it is formidable and dangerous. If there is a monster underground, it is the crushing psychological remoteness that begins to hit every member of the team once you cross about 3 days inbound from the nearest entrance. The deeper you get, the more the presence of what they have come down plays on their mind. And they get into this little cyclonic spiral. And when you can tell that they've got this, and a good old friend of mine, he called this rapture of the deep, you know, kind of a play on Jacques Cousteau. And it's true. You can just see these people. They will typically sit there and wrap their arms around their knees and just sit there. And they kind of like have dilated pupils, more so dilated than you would if you're just down there in the dark. And you can tell that they're obsessed with, are they going to be able to get out?
Why do you think you're immune to the rapture?
Well, I'm not immune to it. It's a matter of degree. When I first started doing expeditionary work in southern Mexico, none of us had ever camped underground. When we got down there, I was doing the same thing. I was thinking, boy, we've just come down a lot of drops, and that bag was really heavy, and we were having gravity assisting us on the way down. Am I going to be able to get out? Well, you know, that was on my mind for the first couple of days. And then, of course, the excitement of being the first to explore that place, you know, pretty much took over. And then at the end, it was basically like, okay, if I can get up one drop, I can get up the next. If I can get up the next, I can get up the one after that. And then it's a matter of routine, just getting used to it. But you still feel this every time you go beyond a personal experience limit.
There are dozens of ways you can die in a cave.
Hell, there are dozens of ways you can die, bicycle traffic.
Yeah, but I mean, when you're in a cave, you're far away from a rescue crew. I mean, the people who work with you know the risks. What are the risks that they're made aware of?
Typically, the two that people worry about are moving water and rockfall. Rocks that have sat there for millennia can be sitting right precariously teetered such that you can walk onto a piece of rock that's the size of a gigantic truck, and the thing will just rock over a couple of degrees. I've had this happen so many times that, you know, it's kind of a joke. They call them the rocking rock, or sometimes they call it the Widowmaker, and other things like that. So every once in a while, they'll roll away from you. Next year, I'll be leading an international team, 2J2. We're going to be shooting for minus 2,600 meters. That's a little over 8,600 feet down at 30 kilometers from the entrance. The lead crews will be underground for pushing 30 days straight. I don't think there's been a mission like that in a long time. Eventually, if you keep going down in these things...
You gave this talk in 2007. You have now been to J2, to this cave that many people believe, or I guess it's been proved, is the deepest cave on Earth. What did you find?
This is a question that many Mexican local residents on these mountains always ask. They think you're bringing out gold. otherwise, why would you do this? There has to be some financial payoff, you know. The answer is the satisfaction that comes out of this whole thing is knowledge. It's hard to explain that to somebody who hasn't been there, but when you get done, three and a half, four months worth of work will typically lead to a couple of squiggles added to a three-dimensional computer map of this cave system within the mountain. And so it's part of the idea of just playing this game out, and it's you against the mountain, mano a mano. And there's a period of about 4 to 5 weeks that we tend to refer to as post-expedition blues. And it's like you're sitting back at your desk going, this is really pretty lame and useless. And, you know, compared to what I was doing something, you know, I was out there on the edge, you know, stepping into ground where nobody had ever been before, you know, exploring, and you can't compete with it. You absolutely cannot compete with it in day-to-day life sitting in a cubicle at a computer.
How important is it for you to get to the deepest place on Earth, to touch that spot?
I'm not obsessed with it. It's more of a thing where as you see these things come together, these are gigantic puzzles. They're three-dimensional chess games inside a mountain, and the game is played out over decades. This is the rationalization that has come. But why do it? I'll tell you why. It's because it is the real frontier on Earth. It is the last terrestrial frontier for humans. Now, you could say, wow, what about the oceans? Well, what about the oceans? We know what's down there. What we don't know, for example, is where the deepest point you can get inside the Earth is. That is still, just like in Jules Verne's age, an unknown open question. And there are people now armed with technology that never existed before that is allowing us to do things that would have been pure science fiction just 40, 50 years ago.
Bill Stone, caver, explorer, and one day moon dweller. Bill's company is now trying to lead a mining expedition to the moon's southern pole. He's hoping to find fuel there to power future space stations. Are you still planning to do that? Do you think that you will plant the flag there on the moon?
The short answer is yes. And we are closer today than we ever were even in 2007 when we made that statement at TED. Things take time. We have agreements, in fact, with all NASA centers regarding technology transfer. So my prediction is that probably within the next year, it's going to happen.
Before you went out to do this epic thing, can you tell me what you did every day?
Yes, I'll try to do this without breaking out in a rash or a panic attack. I'd get up at about 6 o'clock, walk across Kew Bridge, catch the train at 5 to 7, crowd on with all the other commuters, reading their newspapers, and of course not talking. You don't talk on a commuter train. So I'd be at my desk by about 8 o'clock in my little grey cubicle in this enormous office, row upon row upon row of desks, producing whatever it was that we were supposed to produce.
And I think I knew from day one that it wasn't the right job for me.
This is Roz Savage, and she told her story of going to the edge on the TED stage.
That kind of conditioning just kept me there for so many years, until I reached my mid-30s, and I thought, I feel like I've got a purpose in this life, and I don't know what it is, but I'm pretty certain that management consultancy is not it. I sat down one day and wrote two versions of my own obituary. The one that I wanted, a life of adventure, and the one that I was actually heading for. I made a few changes, let go of some of those trappings of my old life, and through a bit of a leap of logic, decided to row across the Atlantic Ocean.
And where did you go from there?
When I first had the idea, I thought I had really no ocean experience. In fact, really, apart from being able to row, I had no other relevant skills whatsoever. But I got to that dangerous stage where I thought, well, just hypothetically, supposing I was going to do this, what would be on my to-do list? And so I made this enormous Excel spreadsheet, this list of all the things that I would need to buy and people I would need to talk to and books I would need to read and courses I'd need to take in order to make this happen. And I'd written the list at such a low level of detail that when I looked down it, I thought, there isn't actually anything there that I don't know how to do. At least I know where to start with it. And so the whole thing started to seem rather frighteningly doable.
How long was the time frame from the moment where you said, I think I want to row across the Atlantic, to the time when you actually did it?
14 months.
Wow.
And it turned out to be the hardest thing I had ever done. Sure, I'd wanted to get outside of my comfort zone, but what I'd sort of failed to notice was that getting out of your comfort zone is by definition extremely uncomfortable. And my timing was not great either. 2005, when I did the Atlantic, was the year of Hurricane Katrina. There were more tropical storms in the North Atlantic than ever before since records began. And pretty early on, those storms started making their presence known. All four of my oars broke before I reached halfway across. But what can you do? You're in the middle of the ocean. Oars are your only means of propulsion. So I just had to look around the boat and figure out what I was going to use to fix up these oars so that I could carry on. So I found a boat hook and my trusty duct tape and splintered the boat hook to the oars to reinforce it. Then when that gave out, I sawed the wheel axles off my spare rowing seat and used those. And then when those gave out, I cannibalised one of the broken oars. I'd never been very good at fixing stuff, but it's amazing how resourceful you can become when you're in the middle of the ocean and there's only one way to get to the other side.
I think about what you did and I think, you must be fearless, like you must fear nothing.
I wish that were true. The first 2 weeks that I was out on the Atlantic, I was terrified. I didn't have confidence yet in my boat that it wouldn't break up, and I also didn't have too much confidence in myself. But I think I learned a few things about fear, and one of them is that there's sort of a limit to how long you can be afraid for. And after a couple of weeks of being abjectly terrified, you sort of get used to it and your comfort zone expands to accommodate your new normality. And the other thing about it is I think you can conquer a fear when you're more afraid of something else. And I was so determined not to go back to my bad old office job that I would have rowed 10,000 oceans rather than admit defeat and go back to the office cubicle.
Your fear was not doing it.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's because both of my parents were Methodist preachers. They were both full-time working for the church. So maybe as a child, I just sort of internalised this idea that you're supposed to have some sort of a higher purpose, some bigger mission in life other than just feathering your own nest.
So this might be a good moment to take quick time out to answer a few FAQs about ocean rowing that might be going through your mind. Number one, what do you eat? I grow my own bean sprouts, I eat fruit and nut bars, and generally arrive about 30 pounds lighter at the other end. Question number two, how do you sleep? Well, I plan my route so that I'm drifting with the winds and the currents while I'm sleeping. On a good night, I think my best ever was 11 miles in the right direction. Worst ever, 13 miles in the wrong direction. That's a bad day at the office. Do I have a chase boat? No, I don't. I'm totally self-supporting out there. I don't see anybody for the whole time that I'm at sea. And finally, am I crazy? Well, I'll leave that one up to you to judge. I really struggled psychologically, totally overwhelmed by the scale of the challenge. There were so many times when I thought I'd hit that limit, but had no choice but to just carry on and try and figure out how I was going to get to the other side without driving myself crazy. And eventually, after 103 days at sea, I arrived in Antigua. I don't think I have ever felt so happy in my entire life. It was a bit like finishing a marathon and getting out of solitary confinement and winning an Oscar all rolled into one. I was euphoric. And to see all the people coming out to greet me and standing along the cliff tops and clapping and cheering, I just felt like a movie star. It was absolutely wonderful. And I really learned then that the bigger the challenge, the bigger the sense of achievement when you get to the end of it.
103 days to row all the way across the Atlantic, but she wasn't done.
So how do you top rowing across the Atlantic? Well, naturally, you decide to row across the Pacific.
Naturally. When we come back, more stories from the Edge, including Roz Savage's Pacific journey. I'm Guy Raz. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, To the Edge. What makes somebody walk to the North Pole or go deep underground or row across an entire ocean by themselves? Well, we pick up our story of Roz Savage. She's a rower who crossed the Atlantic all by herself, and then the next year, she took on the Pacific.
If the Atlantic was about my inner journey, discovering my own capabilities, maybe the Pacific has been about my outer journey, figuring out how I can use my interesting career choice to bring awareness to environmental issues and to bring a human face to the ocean. Well, I thought the Atlantic was big, but the Pacific is really, really big. The first attempt didn't go so well. In 2007, I did a rather involuntary capsize drill three times in 24 hours. Boat got a bit dinged up, so did I. I blogged about it. Unfortunately, somebody with a bit of a hero complex decided that this damsel was in distress and needed saving. First I knew about this was when the Coast Guard plane turned up overhead. I tried to tell them to go away. We had a bit of a battle of wills. I lost and got airlifted.
Were you embarrassed about that, or more angry, or both?
I was mortified, absolutely mortified, and angry. I hadn't called for the Coast Guard. I'd run into a storm about 10 days off the California coast, and the wind speed was, 40 or 50 knots, and the waves were about 20 feet high. And my boat's only 23 feet. The first time the boat capsized was at night, and I was in the cabin. I was actually in there strapped down to my bunk. But on the second capsize, those straps pulled out from the floor of the cabin. So then after that, when the boat capsized again, I was being thrown around a bit like a rag doll in a washing machine.
That sounds terrifying. That sounds totally terrifying.
It's certainly miserable. I didn't think I was going to die because by this point, I'd already spent 3.5 months in my boat on the Atlantic, and I knew that it was a strong boat and that it could withstand some pretty horrendous conditions.
You eventually went back to continue the journey.
Yeah, the following May, I was able to set out again from under the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco on that 8,000-mile voyage across the Pacific, which I did in three stages over the course of 3 years.
Do you think that you'll ever be able to really understand what motivated you to do those things?
That's a very interesting question. I wanted it to be adventurous. I wanted to learn self-reliance. But it still somehow feels like that idea came almost from another place. It was already so fully formed when it popped into my head. And it's interesting, I've sort of been trying to recreate that process recently, now that I've hung up my oars and I'm trying to figure out, you know, if there's going to be a puff of smoke and another big idea pops out. It hasn't quite happened yet, but maybe I just need to be patient with it.
Was there a moment when you were out there, you know, in the middle of the ocean, all by yourself, and you're just like, almost like thinking, I'm so lucky?
Yes, definitely. I think one of the most magical moments was more or less in the middle of the Pacific. It was normally too rough to sleep out on the deck. You just get wet. But this one night was relatively calm, so I dragged out my sleeping bag to make a comfortable little nest between the runners of my rowing seat. And I just lay there looking up at the stars, and there just seemed to be absolutely thousands and millions of stars up there. I just felt incredibly tiny and humble, but at the same time very much connected to and part of it all. And in fact, quite a lot of the time on the ocean, I kind of lost track of self. When you're just there and you're in your routine, you sort of forget about being English or being a woman or being white, or you're just another creature. You're just a rower. You're just there to do your job, to make a few miles across the ocean each day. I imagine it's almost like being a monk or a nun, where you just have your routine and you do your work, and there's a real freedom to be found in that simplicity.
Roz Savage has rowed across the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans in a 23-foot boat. Our latest book is called Stop Drifting, Start Rowing. It's due out in October. You can hear her entire talk at TED.com. Our final story begins August 7th, 1974, New York City.
It started out as another routine morning for a New York helicopter traffic reporter, but he had more to tell his radio listeners than how the traffic was on the West Side Highway.
Well, I'll tell you what, I have a very queasy feeling in my stomach right now because I'm at, 1,500 feet. And up here at 1,500 feet or in that area, there is somebody out there on a tightrope walk between the two towers of the World Trade Center, right at the tippy top.
That somebody was Philippe Petit, a 24-year-old Frenchman, doing his higher wire act 1,350 feet up and no net below.
Certainly, to enter a world of terror, you should not be pushed by someone. You should be called, you should be curious, you should have the heart of an explorer.
He and some associates managed to hide out in the World Trade Center towers overnight, and early this morning rigged a 140-foot steel cable between the two buildings using some sort of crossbow device.
I have been often passing the threshold of the impossible, because the impossible is a human invention. Whenever man goes through or to those apparent limits, if you're being called, it's not as bad as if you're being forced.
Sergeant Charles Daniels, who talked Petit off the high wire, called it a first-rate performance.
He was bouncing up and down. His feet were actually leaving the wire. And then he would go down on one knee and lay down on his back and just completely relax and swing one of his legs over the wire as if he wanted to just take a little nap.
As spectacular sights go, how would you rate this one?
Supreme. The apex of excitement.
You may know this story. It was the subject of an Oscar-winning film called Man on Wire. And in it, French wirewalker Philippe Petit went quite literally to the edge of the World Trade Center and stepped off.
To the edge, that sounds tailored for me.
Philippe was 24 years old when he made that walk between the Twin Towers, and we'll get to the why in a moment. But first, from Philippe's TED Talk, his first step.
On the top of the World Trade Center, my first step was terrifying. There is no recipe, there is no a parameter or algebra formula that I could give to say if you need to concentrate in duress or in an amazing moment in your life, do this and do that. It all depends on who we are. All of a sudden, the density of the air is no longer the same. Manhattan no longer spreads its infinity. The murmur of the city dissolves into a squall whose chill and power I no longer feel. I was intensely focused on walking the wire, which I am anywhere, even when I am not a quarter of a mile in the sky. I lift the balancing pole, I approach the edge. I step over the beam, I put my left foot on the cable. The weight of my body rests on my right leg, anchored to the flank of the building. Shall I ever so slightly shift my weight to the left, my right leg will be unburdened, my right foot will freely meet the wire. An inner howl assails me, the wild longing to flee. But it is too late. The wire is ready. Decisively, my other foot sets itself onto the cable. Faith is what replaces doubt in my dictionary.
Is that what it is? Is it? It's that faith that you will actually do this. You will finish it.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I put one foot on the wire, I have the faith, the certitude that I will actually perform the last step. If not, I will run away and hide in cowardice, you know. So you cannot have a project, a goal, if you don't have faith. If not, it will be like, oh, I hope one day, you know, the success will fall from the sky and, you know, I'll be there to receive it. It doesn't work like that, in my opinion. I remember as 6 years old when I unwrapped, like so many other kids, my first little magic box at Christmas. And I had a desire to practice, to understand, to do in front of the mirror the magic tricks before to rush to my parents or the kids at school and say, hey, take a card. So that sense of perfection is something that marked my life from almost the beginning.
And once he mastered magic, Philippe moved on to juggling, and soon he was spending a lot of time at the circus, watching musicians and jugglers.
And I saw... Oh, no, I didn't see. It was more interesting. I heard about those amazing men and women who walk on thin air, the high wire walkers. Now, I have been playing with ropes and climbing all my childhood, so that's it. I'm 16 and becoming a wire walker.
You were 16.
I found two trees.
When, as you described, you found two trees.
Trees with character.
And you say trees with character, which
oh,
I love.
I'm glad you picked that up. Trees with character. That's I should have that on my business card if one day I have a business card. But you see, that's the big difference between me and, let's say, a regular wire walker, somebody who is able to move their mass from point A to point B, is that first I choose my point A and point B. And if they are not inspiring and beautiful and have some artistry in them, I would go somewhere else.
Philippe, George Mallory, the first Westerner to attempt to scale Everest, was asked, why? You know, why do you want to climb it? And he said, famously, because it's there.
Well, it's a famous question and it's a famous answer because it was there. I would more personally maybe add because it's in there and I will point at my chest, you see, this desire to overcome adversity, this desire to live fully, which we don't see often this day. We don't see people who are happy with their life, you know. They usually wait for retirement or vacation, two notions that I do not comprehend. And I remember many people after my walk between the Twin Towers asked me, so what's next? You cannot do anything anymore. These were the two highest towers in the world, right? And I have a box at home, a red box under my bed, which has, you know, I throw in postcards of a cathedral or a beautiful canyon or the Rapa Nui Island, Easter Island, sites where I would love one day to put a wire. And I will continue to want to place my art in special, meaningful places to do something unique and by that to inspire the one who will look at it.
In his TED Talk, Philippe Petit tells a story about another wire walk he did. It was less well known than the one between the Twin Towers. He was invited to do it by Teddy Kollek, who was the mayor of Jerusalem at the time, and it was to open the Israel Festival.
And I choose to put my wire between the Arab quarters and the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem over the Ben Hinnom Valley. And I thought it would be incredible if in the middle of the wire, I stop and I, like a magician, I make appear a dove and send her in the sky as a living symbol of peace. 80,000 people spread over the entire valley. The mayor of Jerusalem, Teddy Kollek, comes to wish me the best, but he seemed nervous, because actually all those people were people who considered each other enemies. So I start the walk. Everything is fine. I stop in the middle. I make the dove appear. People applaud in delight. And then, in the most magnificent gesture, I send the bird of peace into the azure. But the bird, instead of flying away, goes flop, 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 and ends on my head. And people scream. So I grab the dove, and for the second time, I send her in the air. But the dove, who obviously didn't go to flying school, does flop, 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 and ends up at the end of my balancing pole. So now, you laugh, but hey, I sit down immediately. It's a reflex of wire walkers. Now, in the meantime, the audience, they go crazy. I mean, they must think this guy with his dove, he must spend years working. I mean, what a genius, what a professional. So I take a bow, you know, I salute with my hand, and at the end, I bang my hand against the pole to dislodge the bird. Now, the dove, who now you know, obviously, cannot fly, does for the third time a little flop, 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 and ends up on the wire behind me. And the entire valley goes crazy. Now, but hold on, I'm not finished. So now I'm like, 50 yards from my rival. And I'm exhausted, so my steps are slow. And something happened. Somebody somewhere, a group of people, start clapping in rhythm with my steps. And within seconds, the entire valley is applauding in unison with each of my steps. But not an applause of delight like before. An applause of encouragement. For a moment, the entire crowd had forgotten their differences. They had become one, pushing me to triumph. So after the walk, Teddy and I become friends, and he tells me he has on his desk a picture of me in the middle of the wire with a dove on my head. I mean, he didn't know the true story. And whenever he's daunted by an impossible situation to solve in his, hard-to-manage city, instead of giving up, he looks at the picture and he says, if Philip can do that, I can do this. And he goes back to work. Inspiration. By inspiring ourselves, we inspire others. I mean, I will never forget this music, and I hope now neither will you. Please take this music with you home and start gluing feathers to your arms and look at the world from a different perspective. And when you see mountains, remember, mountains can be moved.
Philippe Petit was the subject of the documentary Man on Wire. His entire talk can be found at ted.npr.org. He's got a new book out. It's all about his latest passion, knots. Like, you know, the ones you tie. It's called Why Not?
Like a bird on a wire. Like a drunk in the midnight choir. I've tried another way. Oh, to be free.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. And you can download and subscribe to this program through iTunes or the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Sanaz Meshkinpour, and Neva Grant, with help this week from A.D. Quigg, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.